Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The question of why women are still underrepresented in the hard sciences and technology professions remains a very open one. My guest today was one of the first female physics majors at Yale University and graduated summa cum laude, yet abandoned her ambition to become a theoretical astrophysicist and became a writer instead. In writing, she says, she found support and nurturing, whereas in physics, despite her talent, she lacked confidence and found no encouragement to go further. A few years ago, after the controversial comments of then-Harvard President Lawrence Summers on why so few women were tenured professors in STEM fields, Eileen Pollack ventured back to Yale to interview her old professors and talk to a new generation of female STEM students, and found that despite several generations of work to promote women in science, subtle bias remains, and most importantly, the same fears and feelings Pollack felt breaking ground back in the 1970s is still at work in female science majors today. She's written a book that combines her own story, a memoir of sorts, with what she found from interviewing students and teachers today in her book, The Only Woman in the Room, Why Science is Still a Boys' Club. It's published by Beacon Press. Today, Eileen Pollack is on the faculty of the MFA program in creative writing at the University of Michigan. She's the author of two very fine novels, as well as two collections of short fiction and award-winning book of nonfiction. And her work has appeared in the Best American Essays and Best American Short Stories. And she joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Eileen Pollack, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here, and I have to apologize for the rough voice. I have a bit of a cold.
Well, we're glad that you're with us today. You write that you had locked your study of physics. You were one of the first undergraduate females to get a BS in physics at Yale, only a few years after it became co-ed. But you said you'd locked it away in a lockbox until you read the comments of then Harvard President Lawrence Summer back in 2005 on why there were so few women in STEM fields. What was your reaction, and why did you start to re-examine your earlier life?
Right. Well, you know, it had been very painful. I had worked so hard to not only get the degree, but really go from, you know, I came in very far behind my classmates because I didn't go to a high school that had advanced placement classes in science and math, and the few advanced courses I wasn't allowed to take because I was a girl, you know, and I worked so hard, and I ended up at the top of my class and then just walked away for reasons that I never really examined myself. It was just sort of an emotional decision. And I felt I had proved that my high school principal hadn't let me take those courses because he said women never went on in science and math. And I felt as if I had fulfilled his prophecy, so I was sort of ashamed of that. And so I didn't re-examine my feelings or even examine them until Larry Summers made that comment. And I happen to know Larry Summers. I knew him from high school debate. And I appreciated that he at least cared, you know, to where very few other men were asking where the women were in physics. So I sat down to write him an email because one of his theories was that there might be genetic differences at the highest end of the spectrum that explain why there were so few women who really, you know, shone in the field. And so I wanted to explain to him the sort of psychological and cultural factors that had really, that really seemed to me to be the reasons. And next thing I knew, I had a 20-page email, which I didn't send, but I realized what I really wanted to do was write a book and examine my reasons in more depth, but find out, talk to a lot of other women and men and see what was really going on and what had or hadn't changed since I had been in school. I eventually sent the book itself to Larry, and he was very gracious and supportive about it. But yeah, so that's how the book came to be.
And those psychological and cultural differences, they're so ingrained, especially when you were a student in the 1970s. As I mentioned, you were one of the first females to earn a BS, but that's mainly because there hadn't been females at Yale till 1969.
Right.
So what I found was really fascinating was not so much the differences between men and women, but the way the various genders reacted to difficulties in the classroom. Right. You're looking at very difficult material. And I think you felt like you came at it from because of those psychological and cultural differences, as if I'm not measuring up, the boys are putting braggadocio, not understanding it any better, and just acting like they do.
It's been really interesting because I've reconnected with some of those boys who were in my class back in the day. We actually, there were only 12 physics majors, and I was the only woman. And as a measure of how isolated I was, the guys didn't even know me. I mean, they read my article or the book and said, this must have been the woman who was in my class. But we had never talked to each other. And when we met all these years later, I met one of them last week, we didn't know each other. I wouldn't have known him if I'd fallen over him. And we had taken classes together, every class together for 4 years, you know? So what was interesting to me is I met several of these guys, and they were tearing up at that my book made them remember how horrible their experiences had been. And they said, and they were really wonderful guys, and they said, we can't imagine if it was worse for you than it was for us. And it must have been, because you were all by yourself. We at least had each other, and we didn't have all these, didn't have to second-guess ourselves because we were guys. That they just couldn't understand how I could have gotten through if it was even worse for me than for them.
Well, The Only Woman in the Room is a memoir of that love of science and the challenges you faced it's really through your youth in Liberty, New York. Now, where is Liberty, New York? Is it? It's out in the hinterlands, isn't it?
Well, it's up in the Catskills in New York State. I should say, though, that it's more what I would call a forensic memoir. So it starts with a question that you can partially answer from your own life, but then you need to move beyond the self to really answer the question in a substantial way. So I want to emphasize that I talk to a lot of young women today to see, I couldn't imagine that they were experiencing what I had experienced so many years ago. And I talk to a lot of sociologists who are now doing, scientific research in gender bias and how all this plays out. And I was just stunned to find that the young women today are pretty much feeling, not all of them, but many of them, that so little has changed, just so little has changed, and that the studies bear out what I experienced all those years ago as something that still is affecting women and minorities today.
And I think several times in the memoir you say, if I would have had a single word, you were top of your class, and if you had a single word of encouragement from any of your professors to pursue a master's degree or a PhD, you probably would have.
Yes, and I think that was one of my real discoveries, first of all about myself, how much that had played a role. And, somebody, when I had an excerpt from the book ran in the Times a year or two ago, and someone commented in the comment section, what was wrong with you? You had, you did get encouragement. How much more did you need? And I had to laugh because the guy was right. I mean, I had good parents. It wasn't like my professors were nice guys who I'm sure wished me well. And so the discovery that that nobody, just because no one said you should go on, I thought that meant that they just thought I was terrible. Really, nobody is really sitting there looking at your grades and deciding what you should do with your future. But girls think that someone is, and that someone will tell them, many girls. But also that there is this ethos in science. My professor said, we don't believe in encouraging anyone, because if you need encouragement, you're not going to make it as a scientist, which I think is really pretty screwy. And so really discovering that ethos and hearing so many professors, women saying it too, which it's very different in other disciplines. I teach writing, and at some point I might stop encouraging somebody, but not at such a, they're trying to weed people out freshman year. And the other myth here is that if all things really were equal and you really weren't encouraging the boys to go on, or the girls, maybe. But the fact is, society is discouraging women and minorities from going on just by all the images and assumptions and stereotypes. And then studies show that professors, and this is women professors too, actually in many sort of unconscious ways encourage their white male students to go on and, really to think of themselves as scientists in ways that they don't even know they're doing.
You know, my background is in arts. The same exists in, I think, some of the arts fields. Because being a professional in the field is so difficult, I don't think most professors, now they will certainly encourage you to go to graduate school, but the idea of becoming an artist, you know, that's something that has to be within inside you. They can't encourage you that.
Right.
You know, and I think the same as, as I was reading through the book, I got the same feeling that, you know, these physicists know how difficult it is to get that PhD and to make a difference in the field. And so I guess maybe they think they shouldn't encourage anybody because you got to have that will and drive and passion.
Right. And of course, it's not just like heaping praise on work that's not good or telling people who are failing an exam, you actually passed it, right? So, you know, I'm meeting with somebody at 11 who's, you know, working on a novel, and it's her first novel. It's very rough going. It's you know, needs a lot of work. You know, she needs some encouragement. It's her first novel. Am I going to still be encouraging her when she's 40? No. If she still needs it, then, you know, it's you know, I'm not going to be able to do anything at that point. But I'm a teacher. Yes, I am encouraging her now. And some of the professors think, well, I'm not, this person doesn't have what it takes to be me, so I'm not going to encourage her or him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you're not going to get a Nobel Prize in whatever field of math you got yours in, but they might make a fabulous math teacher at the secondary level or at a community college or at a liberal arts college or doing something else amazing with math or science, and the same in the arts, right? So mm-hmm. maybe you're not going to be living off your sculpture and have a show at the Met, but you might find some other wonderful thing to do with art, even if you have to support yourself doing something else, right? So it's a question of when, you know, at what point do you stop offering the encouragement, at what point, you know, and do you mix it with liberal doses of reality? So my writing teacher never, you know, he made sure I understood what I'd be getting into if I wanted to be a writer. But he also told me when my work was good, you know, if I wrote something good, he said, this is really good. Yeah. And nobody in physics ever did that. Nobody said, even when I did something good, nobody said, wow, this is really good.
Right. You know, and it was really fascinating to me is one of your physics teachers, you were graduating early and he encouraged you to slow down, take another year, maybe investigate something outside of your field. And I could see where you could take that as, oh, I'm not good enough for physics. And that's how you actually got involved in writing. You ended up studying with John Hersey, who was that wonderful novelist and writer who encouraged you.
Right. I should say, though, that, you know, some people have been reading the memoir as if it's just this diatribe against, you know, every man I ever was in contact with. And it's so much more complex than that. I really was trying to show how complicated it is, you know, not only for me, but for many young people when they're trying to decide what to do. And the person who actually said, slow down, you know, you don't have to graduate in 3 years. If you're going to really go on to grad school, why not have some other things that can enrich your life? I think he was absolutely right. That was great advice. And he's one of the only physicists I know who really tried to have that kind of work-life balance in his own life. And I think that's why I admire that particular guy so much. And so much of the book is really about women wanting more than men or being socialized to want a more rounded life and how, you know, that seems impossible in so many fields today. And that for men as well as women, you know, making things more humane, letting people have, you know, a more rounded, complex life with room for kids or taking care of an aged parent or just even being married, that would benefit everybody. So that professor, in fact, I don't blame him for not having, because I came to him and said, you know, I am going to go on. And he just said, slow down. He didn't say, don't do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that you mentioned, you said, you know, people see, and I think people see the title, The Only Woman in the Room, Why Science is Still a Boys Club. They think it is a diatribe, and I didn't read it as a diatribe at all. I read it as it's just a real interesting, complex look at the psychological and sociological differences that manifest itself.
Right.
And I think it behooves higher education to take those backgrounds into account.
Exactly.
As I mentioned, the book starts out as a memoir, but then after Summer's comments, you go back to Yale and you open that lockbox. You go back and talk to those professors. As a successful writer and novelist, you go back and say, you know, why didn't I go on in physics?
Right.
And what has changed? You mentioned you talked to a lot of young girls at Yale. In fact, the head of the department now is female. And I think she probably thought you were just barking up the wrong trail. And then after a coffee meeting with about 50 undergraduates who were sharing a lot of the same fears and stories that you had experienced in your life, all of a sudden it was eye-opening.
Right. I think that was really the decisive moment when I went back. And, you know, I would have agreed with Megory, who was then the head of the physics department, that, well, we were old and, you know, times were bad when we were young, but things were much better now. And when I went to that coffee, we really only expected 4 or 6 young women to show up, and actually 80 or 90 of them showed up, and their stories were worse than mine. And here were these really, you know, brilliant, but also very sweet and attractive young women who stayed after to say to me that they never told anybody they majored in physics, because if a boy heard that they did, he would, you know, just turn away from them at a party and wouldn't date them, and they were afraid no one would marry them. And, you know, I just was that still was a factor at Yale, you know, that the boys at Yale, they felt, wouldn't want to date them just because they said they were majoring in science. And then I found it was really interesting that that's a cultural thing. That's not true. And there are many other cultures, some with fewer rights for women in other ways, where it's not seen as unfeminine to be good at math or science. So, you know, I really learned a lot by doing the research and writing the book. I didn't understand much of this myself.
I'm wondering if maybe in many ways some of these women today have it tougher because of the competition and sort of our tribal backgrounds, you know, where the competition becomes more pronounced between genders today, whereas when you were going through, it was more, you were an oddity.
Right. I think that there is actually, it does help to have at least one other woman in the room.
True,
so that might help. But I think what makes it actually harder today is that the images of femininity are actually more intense and more exaggerated today than they were, say, in the 60s or 70s when we were rebelling against the 50s, you know? So yeah. We wore jeans and T-shirts. We didn't get our hair done. Nobody got manicures. Nobody planned fancy weddings for, you know, it took a year to plan. And there wasn't this intense focus on being a parent, on being a mother, and like just doing everything imaginable for your kid. So the pressures on women today to concentrate on being just hyper feminine, you know, sort of wearing princess gowns when you're little or dressing in a very sexual way, that a lot of that I think makes the differences between sort of how women are supposed to feel about themselves and how they still perceive some of these hard science fields as being not really compatible with that image.
My guest today is Eileen Pollack, a novelist and nonfiction writer and author of The Only Woman in the Room, Why Science is Still a Boys Club. She was one of the first females to earn a BS in physics at Yale University back in 1978. And she wrote a memoir of her experiences growing up and at Yale, and found when she returned here in the 21st century that things had not really changed all that much. Well, in our last few minutes, what are some suggestions for getting more women into STEM fields and for them to be supportive in helping them nurture a career?
Right. Well, I think there's a lot. It sort of differs by stage, you know, what you're looking at for getting, say, 12 and 13-year-old girls to want to take science and math courses. Those are different steps to take from, you know, how do we react to women who are dropping out of PhD programs or leaving the field after 10 years. So at every step, the, you know, the actual sort of changes you want to make are a little different. But I think behind them all is, first of all, wanting to make a change. So there are people in the field who think that we would be lowering standards to bring in more women and minorities. And I think that, you know, there are 20,000 reasons I can tell you that that's bogus, you know. But so changing that perception and then making just people much more aware and willing to talk about some of the factors that I try to, you know, discuss in the book, which are these more cultural and psychological factors that seem so important. But then there's some really very, you know, more structural, as you go along, you know, family leave and tenure policy, you know, when you're up for tenure, you're trying to do the research for that, and you also have a young child, you know, there are certain changes. They can stop the tenure clock for a year for a man or a woman who's having a kid. You know, or here I'll end with one example. So a study was just done last month that in the biomedical sciences, which you think of as having many more women than men, they studied the average startup package for when you get your first lab. For women, the average was $350,000, which sounds like a lot, but the men were getting something like $870,000, $880,000 as their startup package is the average. It's $500,000 more, right?
Wow. So, over double, yeah.
Yeah, that's in biology. So just making people much more aware of, like, potential differences and, you know, what you might ask for a startup package and getting people just talking about all of this.
Well, the one takeaway I have, it goes back to those conversations with girls in which, you know, you fairly detail how your upbringing in Liberty, New York, in a small town, everything was designed to keep you away from science and math.
Right.
And that still happens in junior highs and high schools around this country, according to those women you spoke with at Yale.
Right. And so I would say to parents, just be aware of what messages your daughters are getting at school, but also what messages you're sending. Because, you know, what tends to happen is girls are not steered toward or subtly steered away from sort of advanced science and math classes. They're teased, still teased, for being good at or interested in, say, robotics or engineering or science and math. And parents tend to let their daughters drop classes or not take the AP exam more readily than they would let their boys drop those classes or steer away from them. So, you know, again, just parents being aware of the messages that their daughters are getting, both from them and from the society and from their teachers, that I think is really important.
Name of the book is The Only Woman in the Room, Why Science is Still a Boys Club. Eileen Pollack, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Eileen Pollack was the first Bachelor of Science in Physics at Yale University. Today she teaches creative writing at the University of Michigan. Her book is titled The Only Woman in the Room, Why Science is Still a Boys Club. It's published by Beacon Press. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Connie Cronley.
On an ordinary day in late June, I spent one of the truly great days of my life. A private tour of the Tallgrass Prairie Preserve with a man named Harvey Payne. Harvey works with the Nature Conservancy, but he's so much more than that. He's a local rancher, lawyer, municipal judge, photographer, naturalist, historian, philosopher, and storyteller. Mr. Payne is the one person who could show me the sandstone cabin that author John Joseph Matthews built in 1932 outside of Pawhuska on the prairie, and where he retreated from the world, hunting and writing about the Osage land and wildlife that he loved so much. Matthews in Osage County has been likened to Thoreau in Walden Pond. His little cabin is little, no more than 15 by 30 feet. For years, it had no running water or electricity. I saw the pump near the house and the outdoor shower. A slab is still there where a screened porch stood, and that's where he slept, summer and winter. The cabin did have a fireplace. The bathroom, I understand, was the grove of blackjacks out back. The only sounds from the prairie and the hay meadow that day were the soft buzzes and chirps from insects and birds. The solitude was peaceful, but the isolation seemed a little odd to me. Mr. Payne said, "If you have enough money, I guess it's called eccentric." And for much of Matthew's life, he had plenty of money from his Osage headwright and his book sales. And then he didn't. But in Mr. Payne's white pickup, we saw a herd of bison in the distance. And after a month of rain, the land was so green and lush, even the ditches by the road were full of wildflowers. He showed me yellow compass plants that look like tall, knobby sunflowers, but they're so rare, they grow only on that prairie. Cattle eat them like candy right down to the ground, which is why they aren't in hay meadows. But Mr. Payne told me bison don't touch them because bison don't eat broadleaf plants. Deer and coyote crossed our paths, and a motionless jackrabbit with big black-tipped ears watched us for a long time. We talked about what the local people thought about the play and film August Osage County. Mr. Payne said, "Well, it's about a dysfunctional family, and some people around here say, 'I think I know the family he's talking about.'" He told me about Osage history, the extinction of elk in the area, the near extinction of bison. But mostly we talked about John Joseph Matthews, his books, his family genealogy from great-grandfather Old Bill Williams and his full-blood Osage wife, and the historic cabin, which is being restored by the Conservancy. Mr. Payne said, "I can relate to him, especially his love of wildlife. The cabin, the land, it was all literary, historic, geographical magic to me." On the way home, I stopped at a Pawhuska restaurant for a nice chicken fried steak and read the local paper. Problems in the oil patch with the federal government, the Ben Johnson Memorial steer roping. That's Ben Johnson Sr., longtime foreman of the old Chapman Barnard Ranch and father of actor Ben Johnson, who was called Son. Small town newspapers often print the police blotter, which I love. Mostly misdemeanors in this one, but one felony described as prisoner placing body fluid on government employee. Now, who knew that was a felony? And here's more good news about my adventure in the great outdoors. I got only 2 ticks.
Connie Cronley is a writer and essayist, the executive director of Iron Gate, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.